From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in jury duty. Well, to be more specific, grand jury duty. Should the system be changed now? In the wake of a number of high-profile cases in the past year, some say the answer is yes. Writing for Slate Magazine Online, Josh Voorhees writes that the grand jury system unduly protects police officers, especially in cases in which an officer kills a citizen. Is he right? What's the history of the grand jury system in this country? What are the proposals, the various ones, that would change it? Jonathan Lippman, the chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals, announced he would be submitting a bill that would require judges to preside over grand jury proceedings in cases involving allegations of homicide or felony assault against police officers, and that transcripts of the proceedings be released in cases of significant public interest, even if the proceedings do not result in an indictment. Tonight at 7 p.m. in Rochester, the League of Women Voters of Monroe County is hosting a panel discussion about the grand jury system, 7 to 8:30 tonight at Asbury First United Methodist Church. That's on East Avenue in Rochester. It is free. But first, three of the members of that tonight are going to be in studio with us for the hour. Let me introduce them now. Sandra Dorley is Monroe County District Attorney. District Attorney Dorley, thanks for being here.
And thanks for having us.
Roger Brazil, the First Assistant Public Defender, is here. Roger, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Reverend Lawrence Hargrave from Asbury First United Methodist Church is the pastor for Outreach and Community Connection, at least for a little while longer.
Thank you for having me.
A few more weeks anyway. Yes. Thanks for being here as well, Reverend. I appreciate your time. I'm going to start with District Attorney Dorley. We see a lot of proposals right now for the grand jury system, but do we need these proposals? Does the system need to change?
Well, you know what? I think it does. I think there needs to be more transparency and more accountability to the citizens of our community. And a few weeks ago, I did write a letter to the editor saying that I would support some transparency. We, as a DA's association, all 62 of us throughout the state of New York, have actually gotten together. We've sat down with the governor. We've come up with some changes that we would like to see to create that transparency in the system.
Okay, in just a moment, we'll talk about some of those specifics. Mr. Brazil, changes needed in the grand jury system?
I think so. I agree that transparency is a big issue. I think really the point of departure between myself and the District Attorneys Association is the degree and extent of the reforms. I think everyone sees a need for it.
Okay. And Reverend, again, I know this may not be your bailiwick, or you're here in many ways to help facilitate the discussion, but I'm always going to allow the door open for you to jump in. Tonight, I want to make sure our community of listeners knows that 7 o'clock, Asbury First United Methodist Church is holding this forum. And what do you perceive as the goal for tonight's event?
Well, we've been involved in a partnership with the League of Women Voters to elevate some issues to the community for discussion and conversation. And because of the things that have happened in Ferguson and the things, the issue in Staten Island, where there were deaths and there were no indictments, and the community, quite frankly, on one hand, you have people who think they're lawyers, and you got other, on the other hand, people who are, like myself, who, understand what we feel are the issues, but
sure,
don't really know the law and want to know more about it. And so hopefully this will be an opportunity for people who are interested from the community to get at least two sides of the conversation and be able to be better informed.
I think that's well said. And I think I'm with you. I mean, there are times where I feel like I understand the system, and there are times where I feel like I don't. We don't need to spend the hour trying to adjudicate cases that we've seen in the last year, but I think you're right, Reverend, in that is an emotional touchstone right now for what we've seen, and that's driving a lot of the conversation. A month ago on this program, former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson was here, and he raised the point that the system has to change because of, in his words, the lack of indictments in these cases. He pointed to Michael Brown, he pointed to Eric Garner and Staten Island, and former Mayor Johnson said that it's not that the police officers were obviously guilty in any way. It's that we missed the chance to actually examine them in a court setting. Let's listen to what Bill Johnson said. And he starts his comments by referencing a different case in Brooklyn in which there was an indictment of a police officer compared to the other ones. Let's listen.
And so now the officer, he's not going to jail yet. He has to go to court. He has to go before a jury, and he has to make his case that it was an accident. And he'll be subjected to cross-examination, something that did not occur in Ferguson, that did not occur in Staten Island that the officer goes before a jury where he can be cross-examined and witnesses can be brought to either substantiate or repudiate him. So this is where we are. This is where we are. And it's very disturbing that we have to really try to differentiate between these cases.
All right, that's former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson. In some ways, District Attorney Dorley, it's not fair to ask you, what should we have done in specific cases? You know, that's not your jurisdiction. You're not working there. We're sort of seeing from afar. But his emotion comes from the fact that he thinks the public didn't get a chance to see a trial and really examine the evidence. Do you agree, at least in general, with the points that Bill Johnson was making?
I do, to some extent. And again, that goes back to the proposal that we are working with, we, the District Attorneys Association, along with the governor, that there would be a check and balance. If there was a police shooting involving an unarmed citizen and that resulted in a no bill, the proposal that we would agree to would be having a special monitor who would be appointed by the governor to review the proceeding, to review the grand jury proceeding, to review the whole entire police package, to make sure that we as district attorneys were doing our lawful and constitutional role in the grand jury. If that special monitor found that we did not in the particular case, then the case could be presented to another grand jury upon court order, and perhaps a special prosecutor be appointed to do it. So it is, the proposal is a check and balance on us to make sure that we're doing our job as district attorneys.
Okay, and what traction are we getting with this proposal? What's your expectation?
I'm hoping that we can reach an agreement. We've had a meeting of the minds with the governor's staff, and I think now it's just the proposal is in bill drafting and making sure that we all have language that we can agree on and support.
All right, Roger Brazil, what do you think about former Mayor Johnson's comments there regarding his frustration over lack of indictment?
I understand the frustration. I was thinking to myself while he was speaking about what happened in the grand juries, and the crux of the problem is we don't know what happened. He said, you know, the police officer wasn't cross-examined and so on and so forth in these cases. We have no way of knowing what happened. There was a lot of supposition, particularly in the Missouri case, that the presentation was as friendly to the defendant or suspect or however you want to characterize the police officer as could be. But we have really, it is just speculation, and that's part of why transparency is necessary.
All right. And so, again, my understanding is that Judge Lipman's proposal would talk about releasing transcripts of grand jury proceedings, even if there's not an indictment. Too far?
Yes, too far. You know, in some respects, we have to keep the secrecy of the grand jury. We use the grand jury as a vehicle to make sure that the right cases ultimately get before a trier of fact. And, you know, the grand jury secrecy is important for the victims and witnesses of the crimes. And I think when we look to whether or not we release grand jury minutes, we release testimony, we need to balance the interests of public safety and the confidentiality that victims and witnesses are at least entitled to in the grand jury process.
All right, Roger, would you agree with the judge's proposal?
I think it's fine. I don't think it goes far enough. I don't understand this idea of protecting the accused or witnesses. I mean, obviously, in the case of Eric Garner, everybody in the country knew who the police officer was. It was on YouTube. He was identified in the paper. So it wasn't as if some person was caught up in a situation and didn't want his name getting out there. It was already out there. And as far as the witnesses, protecting the witnesses is concerned, if there's no indictment, these witnesses are not going to be called upon any further to do anything. And if there is an indictment, their name is going to get out there because they're going to be testifying at a trial, unless the district attorney for some reason obtains a very strict order protecting and not allowing the witness's name to be revealed at trial. So I don't agree with that aspect. I think that the revealing of the transcripts of grand jury testimony, particularly where there's been no indictment, it will go a long way towards dealing with the frustration that a lot of the public has of really what happened, why don't we know what happened.
All right, District Attorney Dorley, where is he wrong?
Well, I actually just read the decision that was issued in the case of Eric Gardner. Several individuals, including, I believe it was the New York Civil Liberties Union, the Legal Aid Society, and some other various organizations, moved for release of the grand jury minutes. And in a very well-written decision, I believe, the court said that there was no compelling and particularized need for their release. But it also talked about the subsequent review of the case for civil prosecution. And again, when we talk about protecting the witnesses and protecting the testimony, that is going to be further examined in a separate proceeding civilly. So we really should be looking at preserving the integrity of the case until final disposition.
Roger, that makes sense to you?
I'm not quite sure I understand protecting the witnesses from being tampered in connection with a civil lawsuit. I just don't see that happening all that often. I think.
But is it possible?
Anything is possible, but there are a number of states throughout the country that do routinely reveal grand jury transcripts. There hasn't been this parade of horribles that everyone thinks, that if we let this witness's testimony get out there. And Judge Lipman's proposal, I believe, calls for redacting the witnesses' names. So it's not even as if a particular person is going to be identified. I think it's a modest proposal, and one that I think everyone should get behind.
All right. If you want to join the conversation with any questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Tonight, 7 to 8:30 at Asbury First United Methodist Church, the League of Women Voters of Monroe County is hosting a forum on the grand jury. It's free. You can attend, and District Attorney Dorley will be there, along with Mr. Brazil, the First Assistant Public Defender, and Reverend Lawrence Hargrave, of course, will be there as the pastor for outreach and community connection there. We're talking about the grand jury and the history and perhaps the future of the grand jury. And District Attorney Dorley, I think it's important to back up and just talk about what the role is to begin with. You know, in the media, I think the widespread, the old saw is that anybody can get a grand jury just to indict a ham sandwich.
Not true? Not true. I've heard that. I've had cases that I've presented that have ended up in no bills or no charges coming forward. So, no, that's not true, but that saying is out there.
You probably would like to put that to rest from here on forward?
I would.
Okay, so what's the rule? Explain for us again, for people who've never, especially if you've never served on any kind of jury duty or not really witnessed a court system, what's the rule?
Sure. The grand jury is, in New York, the only way that you can be prosecuted on a felony offense is by an indictment issued by a grand jury. There is one exception. If everyone is in agreement, the defendant can plead guilty to a superior court information, which replaces the indictment. And that would be something where the court, the defendant, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor all agree on what the plea should be and what the appropriate sentence should be. So putting those aside and that procedure aside, the only way that a person can be tried on a felony offense in New York is through this grand jury process. And a grand jury is made up of 23 citizens who are chosen the same way that trial jurors are chosen. They come in, they are in Monroe County. There are two grand juries, 23 citizens on each, and they sit for a four-week period. The proof standard for a grand jury is different than a trial jury. Evidence is presented, and the grand jury must find there is reasonable cause to believe the person committed the felony offense. If they find that, they hand up an indictment, and that begins the criminal process. Again, the standard is different from proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a lower standard of reasonable cause to believe the person committed the offense. So when a felony comes into Monroe County, and our intention is to put it through the grand jury, the prosecutor will go into the grand jury room. The 23 grand jurors will be there. The prosecutor will put on evidence in the form of a witness. There is no cross-examination. The grand jurors may ask questions. There is no defense attorney. There is no defendant. There is no judge. It's the prosecutor putting the evidence before the grand jury for them to decide whether or not there's enough to charge that person by an indictment to go forward to trial.
Okay, and when we see, for example, Eric Holder's statements after the Department of Justice report on Ferguson, it was kind of two-pronged. First, he was commenting on Officer Wilson's case, and then he was talking about what they called systemic racism. But when it came to Eric Holder's comments, a lot of people, I think, maybe don't understand fully the process, and they're saying, see, it's evidence of innocence. Those terms are probably thrown around too loosely. Is that fair?
I would agree with you. It does not mean that the person was innocent. It just means that the legal standard of was not there. There was not reasonable cause to believe that the person committed the offense.
Okay. Now, Mr. Brazil, go ahead.
Yeah, that's part of the problem and part of the reason for the need for greater transparency. One of the issues in the Staten Island case, the Eric Garner case, is, and I don't see any reason why any prosecutor should be opposed to this, the district attorney was prohibited from telling anyone outside of the grand jury what charges he presented to the grand jury. Now, in a case like that, as Mr. Orley knows, I mean, there's several levels of homicide that could have been charged. And it's really up to the prosecutor to decide which ones to put to the grand jury. Now, if the only charge that he put up there was murder in the second degree and the grand jurors said, you know, this isn't murder, they would issue a no bill. If the district attorney charged the grand jury on all of the lesser counts and they rejected each one of them, that's a different matter. But we don't know what happened. So that's part of the problem when we say the grand jury didn't find that there were probable cause to believe that the offense was committed. It may be that the level of offense that was presented to the grand jury wasn't established by reasonable cause. It may be that a lesser offense was, and we just don't know.
But why wouldn't a prosecutor offer all possibilities?
It's entirely up to the district attorney to do that. And part of the concern that the public had in New York City and throughout the state, and frankly elsewhere, is that the district attorney's office and the police work together on a day-to-day basis. And you don't foster that relationship by indicting police officers for serious crimes.
All right. That's a strong statement, and it dovetails with a comment I just got from a listener, and let me read it, and then we'll go around the table on this. Jake writes, "Transparency and accountability are key, of course, but one problem seldom addressed is closeness. Although not on a personal level, perhaps the DAs are no stranger to the departments they're investigating more often than not. Even the judges are seldom far from outside the local system to be truly unbiased. What are your guest thoughts on fully independent special prosecutors in all grand jury trials involving police-involved deaths of any kind?" Roger?
That was essentially Attorney General Schneiderman's proposal. I don't think it's got the traction that he hoped it would. He thought and he proposed in any case where there was a police officer civilian homicide and a grand jury investigation that it be headed by somebody from the Attorney General's office who's outside of the loop of the normal county politics involved in law enforcement. Some people feel that was an insult to prosecutors. In fact, the one who was argued the strongest against it was District Attorney Thompson in Kings County in Brooklyn, who actually did indict the police officer in the shooting in the housing project stairwell. So I understand both sides, and I understand feelings can get hurt. I think, though, that the public sees, if it's just from CSI or whatever that TV show is, where the police, the prosecutor, they basically work together in the perception of the public, and that doesn't lend itself to complete objectivity.
District Attorney Dorley, what do you think?
You know, being a prosecutor for 24 years and being someone who's actually indicted police officers, you know what? We have to look at each case fairly on the facts. If there is a case where we feel that our relationship is too close, that we would not be doing our job as is warranted to our constituency, then we have the need and we have the ability to get a special prosecutor. So I think it must be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I know that if I felt that our relationship between myself or anyone in my office was too close to a particular police officer, I would ask for a special prosecutor to come in and handle that.
Have you ever done that?
Not with respect to a police officer, no. But with other cases, yes.
Okay. Roger, again, the district attorney saying that system, that opportunity is already in place for cases where anyone feels too close, that you can get a special prosecutor, that we're not precluded from that currently.
Well, the governor's proposal, I think, takes it one step removed, which says if there's no indictment, some special monitor will make a determination whether a special prosecutor is needed. If you leave the decision to the individual elected district attorney to make a decision about whether a special prosecutor should be appointed, the public is going to have the same feeling of the game is sort of rigged in law enforcement's favor.
Okay. Let me also read one other possible proposal here, because we're trying to sift through all the different ideas that are out there. And it does look like there's some movement anyway. Much as our panelists may disagree on certain points, it does look like there's agreement that some change is needed. Here's an idea from Paul McMahon, a law professor at the London School of Economics, who argues in a forthcoming Yale Law and Policy Review article that the solution may sound outlandish to some and seems outdated to some, but he's calling for a system of inquest, a quasi, you're smiling already, District Attorney. Let me go ahead and read this, because this is an actual proposal. A quasi-judicial proceeding with medieval roots that's largely fallen by the wayside in our country. Inquests, which are still common in England and Ireland, are called in the aftermath of an unexpected or unusual death. Typically, a jury with the help of a judge or coroner seeks to establish the facts of the case, but, more importantly, has no legal authority to indict or convict. Think of this as akin to a civilian review board, but with more power, a clearer task, and an actual platform to make sure its conclusions are heard. How would it work? McMahon proposes launching one automatically anytime a police officer kills someone in the line of duty. Having either a judge or coroner lead the jury would remove the apparent conflict of interest of a district attorney investigating an officer who he relies on to do his job. The inquest would have the power to compel witnesses to testify under oath, but unlike a grand jury, the proceedings would play out in public. The bigger wrinkle, though, is that the jury would have no power to decide the question of criminal or civil liability. The findings wouldn't necessarily even be admissible as evidence in a court of law. Prosecutors would still be the ones to decide whether to take the case to a grand jury. The grand jury would still decide whether to indict the officer, but an inquest would bring a heavy dose of public accountability. Hmm. Now, you're smiling. You're not on board.
No, well, whenever you say inquisitional system, we moved away from that, you know, years and years ago. And
hundreds
I think,
of years
hundreds,
ago?
Maybe a thousand of years ago. And you know what? We really, I respect the balance of power. But the more you read, the more it's an interesting proposal. You know what? I think all of us really need and want to get to the heart of what happens. And we all want a fair and balanced way to get to the truth. So it's interesting, I would say.
Okay. See, you came around a little bit.
I did, after my initial
The word
sneer.
Inquest can throw someone off.
It did.
I understand.
It did.
Roger, what do you think?
It's kind of ironic because the grand jury traces its roots back to 12th century England. But England abolished grand juries 1933, they have a system of pretrial hearings, what we would call a preliminary hearing. And many states in our country do the same thing. And everything is out in the open. So I find it kind of ironic that he would be suggesting this, because England is already past that point, I think.
Hunter wants to know, how often does the district attorney go to a grand jury and not get an indictment?
Oh, I have those statistics, Hunter.
Okay.
Thank you, Hunter.
I did
come prepared with statistics, because it is interesting to know. Hunter, let me tell you, every year approximately 5,000 felony cases and investigations come through the district attorney's office. In 2014, 4,716 felonies were submitted to the office. Now, Let me tell you about what happened in 2014 in terms of, as I'm switching pages here, of how many were indicted versus how many were no-billed. And you were a little too fast there.
That's okay.
In 2014, 1,427 felonies were indicted by a Monroe County grand jury, 488 defendants pled guilty to waiver pleas. That's at Superior Court information, which waives the indictment process. But 392 cases were no-billed or returned as misdemeanors. A no-bill means that obviously no charges were filed. So even though police may have arrested a suspect or a defendant, they did not result in charges because of the grand jury process.
All right, so 392 no-bill, 427 indictments, 488 pleading guilty, so eliminating the need for that process, right?
Right, 488, okay. Right, the Superior Court information waiver, the waiver of the indictment process.
So almost 4-1 for you to get an indictment versus a no-bill. And to you as a district attorney, does that mean that you're doing your job, that you're going to the grand jury when there is a good reason to and that the statistics reflect that?
Yes. I think we are. And you know what? There are cases where, you know, a witness may or a victim of a crime may make out a felony complaint along with the police officer, and we find out later that perhaps they, their recollection of the facts were not as clear. And that's the check and balance on the system. So not everyone who gets arrested ends up with a felony indictment.
How often are you surprised by the results? I guess 392 times, maybe.
Right. I mean, it gets back to the ham sandwich. There is not a ham sandwich. You know, we are surprised. Mm-hmm.
I think, to be fair, of that 392, there's a substantial number where just no witnesses showed up.
Is that right?
It could be for whatever particular reason that they don't want to cooperate with the police, that they may have, you know, falsified the claim to begin with. There could be many reasons, or we can't locate the witnesses anymore. And that's important. We need to be able to substantiate the case. If we're going to present a case and ask a grand jury to issue an indictment, you know, we better have evidence behind that.
In other words, you can be surprised. This isn't it's a higher bar to clear than some may think.
It is. And we have been surprised. I personally have been surprised.
Okay. Roger, then, when you look at those numbers, are you comfortable with the numbers? I mean, do the statistics show that the system is working to you?
I'm not. It's a kind of broad question. As I said, of the no bills, there's a couple of classes of cases that very frequently just are dismissed because no one shows up. Usually, when it's a complaint against a family member or a household member or something of that nature, some young lady takes mom's credit card and starts charging stuff up. And mom is angry at the beginning and then decides maybe this isn't the best way to deal with the situation. There, frankly, are a number of domestic violence kinds of complaints where there are felony charges brought and then witnesses or complainants don't appear. How many of these are actually cases in which a grand jury heard full, fair evidence in the case and decided that there wasn't? I mean, I have no way of telling. I certainly have had cases that have been no-billed over the years, but it's not a frequent occurrence. It's not something that I count on happening.
Okay. Tom writes to us and wants to know from the public defender on the panel. Tom says, I feel like the grand jury system tilts against the black community. Does he agree? Again, you talk about a hard question. I mean, that's I don't know exactly what Tom and Tom. Feel free to call the program and elaborate on that because I don't know exactly why Tom is saying that. But if you want to call in, Tom, you can 844-295 talk to do it. Roger, how would you answer that generally?
I think this again speaks to the need for transparency. I think if people could see what happened in the grand jury, they would come away with it either with a better or a worse, but at least a better informed idea of what happened. And I can't say that the institution of the grand jury is in some way institutionally racist, but I understand the perception, particularly after these kinds of high-profile cases, that people have questions and they are not getting answers, and they sometimes some people will assume the worst.
All right, if you're just joining us, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we'll reset some of the proposals that are out there that would change the grand jury system and our guests say probably improve the process as we seek to understand it better. There's a forum tonight, 7 to 8:30 at Asbury First United Methodist Church. That's on East Avenue in Rochester. The League of Women Voters in Monroe County is sponsoring this event that looks at the grand jury in our country and in our state, 7 to 8:30 tonight if you want to attend. And our guests in studio will be there. They're here for the hour. Sandra Dorley, Monroe County District Attorney, Roger Brazil, the First Assistant Public Defender, and Reverend Lawrence Hargrave from Asbury First United Methodist Church. We're coming right back here on Connections on member-supported public radio. In just a moment, I'm going to get to your phone calls. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, as we talk about the grand jury system and whether it needs to be changed here on Connections. But Reverend Hargrave wanted to follow up on Tom's question about whether the grand jury system is tilted against the black community. Reverend?
And I want to say this as a black man. I look at these high-profile cases with my own particular history, and I've been one who, I'm from Buffalo. I grew up in a neighborhood that, had some interactions with the police department. I had my own, not from doing anything, but, one day I was running home from the Y, and a police officer followed me into my home and with his gun out, mistook me for someone else, and had his partner not come in behind him, we might not be having this conversation. But over my own personal history, I mean, I've worked with the former mayor, Bill Johnson. I did the report on police community relations with Judge Michael Miller, and we were in the studio talking about that. I've been part of Project Exile with collaboration between law enforcement to get illegal guns off the street. But I also understand when I watch what happened with Eric Garner, I put myself in his place and think, I'm disobeying a police officer, and the next thing I know, I'm being choked and thrown to the ground. And then in the midst of that, no one comes to my aid. And then it goes to a grand jury and nothing happens. But the entire, not the Staten Island community, not New York State, but the entire world saw that happen. And then there's no indictment. And so personally, that leaves me troubled with, if I'm in the wrong situation, would I get justice?
Well, let me get to the phones now. This is Mary Jane in Webster. Go ahead, Mary Jane.
Yes. I was on a trial jury several times, and I also served on a grand jury once. That was when we had Howard Rellon around many years ago, 60s, I guess. And I came away from any of the trials with pleased with the way things had gone and the decisions that were made. But at about that time, I was given a book about the need for change in the grand jury system, written by the late Ralph Borazuski. And I think it would very... I scoured my shelves, and I can't find the book. And I probably lent it somewhere and never got it back. But this committee should be made aware of that with all his suggestions for change. And he's a local writer. He's from Rochester.
Well, Mary Jane, thanks for the call. I think it illustrates that we've been talking about change in the system for a long time and how to improve it. We probably always will be. I mean, that's probably the nature of our legal system. We're always going to look for ways to improve it. But that's a good chance to kind of reset the conversation if you're just joining us. So let me ask District Attorney Sandra Dorley, again, for those just joining us, what's the proposal that the District Attorneys Association is supporting? How would that change the grand jury system?
Sure. The two main issues that we are advocating. One would be the ability to issue a letter or report. So if a case is no billed, that we as district attorneys would be able to issue to the community a report or a letter as to why the case ended up the way it did. The second one is our support for the position of a special monitor, which would be a check and balance against our role in the grand jury. So say, for example, that a case involving a police officer and an unarmed civilian resulted in a no bill. Once that no bill was issued, the special monitor within 30 days would have access to the grand jury minutes, would have access to the police reports, and would make an independent finding as to whether or not we fulfilled our obligation in the grand jury. If that special monitor found that we did not, and there's a certain legal standard that would have to be met, then that case could be presented to another grand jury upon court order, and perhaps a special prosecutor would take over the presentation in that case. So it's a check and balance on our system. And again, the transparency, our need to be able to explain to the community, to our constituency, why a case ended the way it did is tantamount to transparency.
Okay. And Roger Brazil, explain what you would like to see happen. You just heard the proposed changes.
Yeah. I'll be quite honest. I have thought about this a long time over the weekend. I'm more and more attracted to the argument that the grand jury system has really just outlived its usefulness, and that there are other ways to achieve what a grand jury does. But since grand jury indictment is guaranteed by the New York State Constitution, it would take a constitutional amendment to abolish it, and I don't foresee that happening. So if we're working within the parameter of a grand jury, I think that Judge Lippman's proposal makes a lot more sense for a couple of reasons. Ms. Dorley had spoken before about the decision by Judge Garnett in the Garner grand jury minutes, the request from various agencies, including the New York Post, was one of the plaintiffs in the case. The decision was kind of predictable because the case law has been so uniformly directed towards never disclosing any portions of grand jury testimony. So there's not a whole lot of cases in which the courts have allowed disclosure. Judge Lippman's proposal would, not just in police civilian cases, but in any case where the court finds that the subject matter is an important to the public, and the person under investigation his identity is already known, that there would be guidelines set up for a judge to decide whether or not to release grand jury testimony with names redacted, and that there would be a presumption in favor of that. And I think that makes sense. The other part of his proposal, which I think does make sense, is that he wants to put a judge right into the grand jury room and let the judge rule on issues of evidence. There are rules of evidence that apply in a grand jury proceeding, but it's the district attorney himself who enforces those rules. He's presenting the case, or she's presenting the case, and she is, in a sense, reviewing her own decisions by being the legal advisor to the grand jury. If you had a judge in there, it would remove some of that and be a little bit more independent. And the third thing, which the judge would, why I like Judge Lippman's proposal, the judge would decide what charges get presented to the grand jury. The judge would decide what charges the grand jury could hear based on the testimony that was presented. And I think that makes sense. It is not an infrequent situation currently where after a person has been indicted, when the case is now assigned to a trial judge, a motion is made by the defense attorney to ask the trial judge to inspect the grand jury minutes and see, is the evidence before the grand jury sufficient to support this charge? And it's not an unusual or unheard of for judges to say, no, this evidence did not support this charge. It might have supported a lesser charge, but it didn't support the highest count. If you had the judge write in the grand jury, you wouldn't need that additional step.
District Attorney Dorley, if you put a judge right in the grand jury room, how would it change things for you?
Well, I feel it would be, there's a separation of power. I believe it's not necessary. I believe that the special monitor would, in essence, serve the same role, because that special monitor would be reviewing the grand jury minutes, just as courts and judges do for every indictment, as Mr. Burzell was saying. To me, it becomes more of an inquisitional system rather than an adversarial system. It violates the separation of powers. And again, there are reasons why we have to protect the secrecy of the grand jury. Not that a judge would violate any of those reasons, but checks and balances, yes, but to actually put a judge into the grand jury process would be... We would not be for that proposal.
Okay, so checks and balances, Roger. Again, are there supposed to be checks and balances in that part of the system?
Well, first of all, although the right to a grand jury indictment is guaranteed by the New York State Constitution, the whole rule about grand jury secrecy is nowhere in the Constitution. It's a statute that was passed by the legislature. The same statute says that both the judge and the district attorneys are to be the legal advisors to the grand jury. But as Judge Lipman noted in his State of the Judiciary address, by and large, the only part that a judge takes in advising the grand jury is when the grand jury is first sworn in. He gives them sort of preliminary instructions about their work. But he doesn't know what's going on during the 4 weeks of the grand jury's actions, unless in a very, very rare circumstance, either the prosecutor or sometimes the defense attorney who happens to be present will go to the judge and ask for a ruling on some. But that never happened in my experience. I've heard of it, but it's a rare instance.
It does happen. I mean, there's a Part One judge that's assigned to advise every grand jury of their responsibilities. They are on call for issues that come up during the course of the sitting of the grand jury.
My point being, though, that in terms of checks and balances, that Judge Lipman is saying the judge already is the legal advisor or one of the two legal advisors. Put him into the courtroom where he can do some real advising.
Christopher writes to us, thanks for hosting this discussion. I'm confused about what you would replace a grand jury system with. And Roger, you just mentioned this. So answer Christopher's question. How would you replace it?
There are different schemes in different states. California, for instance, has a very elaborate system for preliminary hearings, which basically take the form of a mini trial. And a judge hears all of the evidence. There's no jury. And the judge decides, is there enough evidence for this case to actually go to trial? When England replaced the grand jury, they did so because the grand jury essentially became redundant because they had passed a number of what they call committal proceedings for holding a person in custody. You had to show that there was some basis to do so. You had to show enough evidence to convince a judge that there was a reason to hold this person in custody until he got his day in court. So there are various ways to do it, and all of them would be more transparent than the grand jury.
What do you think about that, District Attorney Dorley?
You know, for the most violent of cases, that sometimes, you know, they happen in neighborhoods, and we as law enforcement officials have a very difficult time getting people to cooperate. We are able to use the grand jury and the secrecy of the grand jury to get people to come in and do the right thing so we can get the worst of the worst and the most violent offenders off the street. It is a protective mechanism for them because you know what? They've got to go back in those neighborhoods and they have to live there. And sometimes doing the right thing isn't looked upon very nicely. So we use it as a mechanism to really promote public safety and get people to come forward and do the right thing.
And it could erode your ability to do that. Absolutely.
And let me talk about, you know, rape victims, child victims. If you go through this preliminary hearing type replacement rather than a grand jury with a secret proceeding, you could have young victims, rape victims, who had just experienced the most traumatic thing in their life, having to face their accuser within a very short time. You know what? We have to. It's a balancing effort here, and we have to really promote public safety.
All right, Roger. Again, one quick rebuttal point to that, because again, I think she's talking about something that we hear about all the time, which is, can we get people to cooperate, and will this compromise the ability of law enforcement to get people to cooperate?
This period of protection that she's referring to only lasts from the time that the grand jury reaches an indictment until the time that the case comes to trial. At that point, all of the witnesses are going to be known to everyone. So they still have to go back to those neighborhoods. They've testified against an individual. There's really no difference. This protection is really only for a relatively brief period of time between when the grand jury hears the case and when the case ultimately comes to trial.
And sometimes that can be 6 months to a year. So it gives the witnesses, it gives the victims, the families protection, that guaranteed protection for just a little while longer. Maybe it's enough time for them to relocate or, you know, to take other precautions. But that protection should be given and afforded to those individuals.
All right. You're hearing some disagreement on how to improve the system, but at least an agreement on the panel that there are ways to make it better. I think there are just differences of degrees being proposed here as we look at transparency and what sort of the costs and benefits are of changing the grand jury system. The event tonight starts at 7 o'clock at Asbury First United Methodist Church on the grand jury system, hosted by the League of Women Voters of Monroe County. And all the panelists you hear on this panel are going to be there tonight. It's a free event. And let me turn to Reverend Hargrave. Again, I go back to your comments about what moved you about Eric Garner. And so much of the conversation about the grand jury system now has been sparked by these high-profile cases. And it occurs to me, Reverend, that we probably need to get to a point where we can address these incidents and not feel like we're so polarized that if we talk about them, some people say, well, you're attacking police. I want to be able to address cases case by case and not feel like it's attacking all police. At the same time, we don't want to get to a point where we feel like we're telling certain communities all police are against you when they're doing dangerous and important work. And we've got to find a way to balance that. And I don't know always how to do that, but what do you think?
Well, I will take it a little bit further than that. You know, looking at the jury selection process, I mean, you know, when you have a secret grand jury, you don't know what the racial makeup of that jury is. And, you know, I'm sorry. I mean, I love and respect everybody in this room, but we all have different perspectives. We all have different histories. We all have come from different situations. And so, you know, the way we select juries does not assure me as an African-American that I'm going to be fully represented.
Okay. District Attorney Dorley, what are your thoughts on just striking that balance between feeling like if a police officer does wrong, because again, this is an officer of the law with a weapon. If they do wrong, which thankfully doesn't seem to be very often at all, but that we can know that they will be prosecuted fully, but also to make sure that we're not telling certain communities that we're against you or that the police are against you. And how do we raise people to respect police for the work they're doing while also knowing that if they do wrong, they will be held accountable?
Right. Because the respect should go both ways. Absolutely. Police respecting the community respecting the police. The transparency will help, will build that respect. But we also need diversity. We need diversity in the grand jury. We need diversity in our jury system. We need people to come in, and we need them to volunteer and not to think of every excuse to get off a jury. It needs to be a grand jury of their peers and a jury of your peers.
Okay. Roger?
There's no argument with any of those points. Both the grand jury and the trial juries have a tendency to have fewer people of lower economic means because of daycare problems, because they work a job where they're not going to get paid. If they, you know, I don't even know what grand jury, what jurors get paid now. I think it's $25 a day or something ridiculous like that. They don't even pay for your parking anymore. So those people can't afford. They got to put food on the table for their family, so they can't afford. So you find that juries are more stilted towards people who have money and retired people, and people who have, you know, more means, and that in Rochester and throughout the country has it takes on a racial aspect to it. There's no question about it. I mean, you see fewer black faces and Hispanic faces on trial juries, and it's not simply because the Commissioner of Jurors doesn't do everything in his power to try to get jurors in there, but the practical realities are. A woman comes in, she says, I've got three kids, I've got nobody to care for them, it's going to be a great... I don't want her on my jury if she doesn't want to sit on the jury. I mean, that's
or
not...
Or feels like she can't afford to.
Yeah, and she can't afford it. And you know, it varies from court to court and from judge to judge how lenient they're going to be in excusing those people, but it's difficult because I don't think either side, I don't think the prosecutor or the defense attorney wants somebody sitting on the juror who doesn't want to be there.
Raise the per diem, pay for their parking. Does anybody disagree?
No, 100% agree.
Everyone agrees on that. And I think that that's a small but good way to start. And on top of that, if we get called to jury duty, I'm going if I get called.
Please. Please. I mean, most people, they end up loving the experience and being
and
very happy.
Absolutely.
And learning and being very happy that they were a part of the system.
7 o'clock tonight. Thanks for the time of our panelists. Sandra Dorley, Monroe County District Attorney, thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Brazil, as a First Assistant Public Defender, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Reverend Hargrave. See you tonight, 7 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is Member Supported Public Radio.